This is Audible.
Audible Frontiers presents The Word for World is Forest, written by Ursula K. Le Guin and narrated by Kevin Parisot.
Chapter 1. Two pieces of yesterday were in Captain Davidson's mind when he woke, and he lay looking at them in the darkness for a while. One, up. The new shipload of women had arrived. Believe it or not, they were here in Centralville, 27 light-years from Earth by Nafal and 4 hours from Smith Camp by Hopper. The second batch of breeding females for the new Tahiti colony. All sound and clean, 212 head of prime human stock. Or prime enough, anyhow. One down. The report from Dump Island of crop failures, massive erosion, a wipeout. The line of 212 buxom, beddable, breasty little figures faded from Davidson's mind as he saw rain pouring down onto plowed dirt, churning it to mud, thinning the mud to a red broth that ran down rocks into the rain-beaten sea. The erosion had begun before he left Dump Island to run Smith Camp, and being gifted with an exceptional visual memory, the kind they call eidetic, he could recall it now, all too clearly. It looked like that Big Dome Keys was right, and you had to leave a lot of trees standing where you planned to put farms. But he still couldn't see why a soybean farm needed to waste a lot of space on trees if the land was managed really scientifically. It wasn't like that in Ohio. If you wanted corn, you grew corn, and no space wasted on trees and stuff. But then, Earth was a tamed planet, and New Tahiti wasn't. That's what he was here for, to tame it. If Dump Island was just rocks and gullies now, then scratch it. Start over on a new island and do better. Can't keep us down. We're men. You'll learn what that means pretty soon, you godforsaken damn planet, Davidson thought. And he grinned a little in the darkness of the hut, for he liked challenges. Thinking men, he thought women. And again the line of little figures began to sway through his mind, smiling, jiggling. Ben, he roared, sitting up and swinging his bare feet onto the bare floor. Hot water. Get ready. Hurry up quick. The roar woke him satisfyingly. He stretched and scratched his chest and pulled on his shorts and strode out of the hut into the sunlit clearing, all in one easy series of motions. A big, hard-muscled man, he enjoyed using his well-trained body. Ben, his creechy, had the water ready and steaming over the fire as usual, and was squatting, staring at nothing, as usual. Creechies never slept. They just sat and stared.
Breakfast. Hurry up quick, Davidson said,
picking up his razor from the rough board table where the creechie had laid it out ready with a towel and a propped-up mirror. There was a lot to be done today, since he'd decided, that last minute before getting up, to fly down to Central and see the new women for himself. They wouldn't last long. 212 among over 2,000 men. And like the first batch, probably most of them were colony brides, and only 20 or 30 had come as recreation staff. But those babies were real good greedy girls, and he intended to be first in line with at least one of them this time. He grinned on the left, the right cheek remaining stiff to the whining razor. The old creechy was moseying around, taking an hour to bring his breakfast from the cookhouse.
"Hurry up quick,"
Davidson yelled, and Ben pushed his boneless saunter into a walk. Ben was about a meter high, and his back fur was more white than green. He was old, and dumb, even for a creechy, But Davidson knew how to handle them. He could tame any of them, if it was worth the effort. It wasn't, though. Get enough humans here, build machines and robots, make farms and cities, and nobody would need the creatures anymore. And a good thing, too. For this world, New Tahiti was literally made for men. Cleaned up and cleaned out, the dark forests cut down for open fields of grain, the primeval murk and savagery and ignorance wiped out, it would be a paradise. A real Eden. A better world than worn-out Earth. And it would be his world. For that's what Don Davidson was, way down deep inside him, a world tamer. He wasn't a boastful man, but he knew his own size. It just happened to be the way he was made. He knew what he wanted and how to get it, and he always got it. Breakfast landed warm in his belly. His good mood wasn't spoiled even by the sight of Keyes Van Sten coming towards him, fat, white, and worried, his eyes sticking out like blue golf balls.
"Don," Keyes said without greeting, "the loggers have been hunting red deer in the strips again. There are 18 pair of antlers in the back room of the lounge."
"Nobody ever stopped poachers from poaching, Keyes."
"You can stop them. That's why we live under martial law. That's why the army runs this colony, to keep the laws."
A frontal attack from Fatty Big Dome. It was almost funny. "All right," Davidson said reasonably. "I could stop them. But look, it's the men I'm looking after. That's my job, like you said. And it's the men that count, not the animals. If a little extra-legal hunting helps the men get through this godforsaken life, then I intend to blink. They've got to have some recreation."
"They have games, sports, hobbies, films, teletapes of every major sporting event of the past century. Liquor, marijuana, Hallies, and a fresh batch of women at Central for those unsatisfied by the Army's rather unimaginative arrangements for hygienic homosexuality. They are spoiled rotten, your frontier heroes, and they don't need to exterminate a rare native species for recreation. If you don't act, I must record a major infraction of ecological protocols in my report to Captain Goda."
"You can do that if you see fit, Keyes," said Davidson, who never lost his temper. It was sort of pathetic, the way a Euro like Keyes got all red in the face when he lost control of his emotions. "That's your job, after all. I won't hold it against you. They can do the arguing at Central and decide who's right. See, you want to keep this place just like it is, actually, Keyes. Like one big national forest. To look at, to study. Great, you're a spesh. But see, we're just ordinary Joes getting the work done. Earth needs wood. Needs it bad. We find wood on New Tahiti, so we're loggers. See, where we differ is that with you, Earth doesn't come first, actually."
"With me, it does."
Keyes looked at him sideways out of those blue golf ball eyes.
"Does it? You want to make this world into Earth's image, huh? A desert of cement."
"When I say Earth, Keyes, I mean people. Men. You worry about deer and trees and fiberweed. Fine, that's your thing. But I like to see things in perspective, from the top down. And the top, so far, is humans. We're here now. And so this world's going to go our way. Like it or not, it's a fact you have to face. It happens to be the way things are. Listen, Keyes, I'm going to hop down to Central and take a look at the new colonists. Want to come along?"
"No thanks, Captain Davidson,"
the Spesh said, going on towards the lab hut. He was really mad. All upset about those damn deer. They were great animals, all right. Davidson's vivid memory recalled the first one he had seen here on Smithland. A big red shadow, 2 meters at the shoulder, a crown of narrow golden antlers. A fleet, brave beast, the finest game animal imaginable. Back on Earth, they were using robo-deer even in the High Rockies and Himalaya parks now. The real ones were about gone. These things were a hunter's dream. So they'd be hunted. Hell, even the wild creatures hunted them, with their lousy little bows. The deer would be hunted because that's what they were there for. But poor old bleeding-heart Keyes couldn't see it. He was actually a smart fellow, but not realistic. Not tough-minded enough. He didn't see that you've got to play on the winning side or else you lose. And it's man that wins. Every time. The old conquistador. Davidson strode on through the settlement, morning sunlight in his eyes, the smell of sawn wood and wood smoke sweet on the warm air. Things looked pretty neat for a logging camp. The 200 men here had tamed a fair patch of wilderness in just 3 months. Smith Camp. A couple of big choroplast geodesics, 40 timber huts built by Creechy labor, the sawmill, the burner trailing a blue plume over acres of logs and cut lumber. Uphill, the airfield and the big prefab hangar for helicopters and heavy machinery. That was all. But when they came here, there had been nothing. Trees. A dark huddle and jumble and tangle of trees. Endless, meaningless. A sluggish river overhung and choked by trees. A few creechy warrens hidden among the trees. Some red deer, hairy monkeys, birds, and trees. Roots, boles, branches, twigs. Leaves overhead and underfoot and in your face and in your eyes. Endless leaves on endless trees. New Tahiti was mostly water. Warm, shallow seas broken here and there by reefs, islets, archipelagos, and 5 big lands that lay in a 2,500-kilo arc across the northwest quarter sphere. And all those flecks and blobs of land were covered with trees. Ocean, forest, that was your choice on New Tahiti. Water and sunlight, or darkness and leaves. But men were here now to end the darkness and turn the tree jumble into clean, sawn planks, more prized on earth than gold. Literally, because gold could be got from seawater and from under the Antarctic ice, but wood could not. Wood came only from trees, and it was a really necessary luxury on earth. So the alien forests became wood. 200 men with robo-saws and haulers had already cut 8-mile-wide strips on Smithland in 3 months. The stumps of the strip nearest camp were already white and punky. Chemically treated, they would have fallen into fertile ash by the time the permanent colonists, the farmers, came to settle Smithland. All the farmers would have to do was plant seeds and let them sprout. It had been done once before. That was a queer thing. And the proof, actually, that New Tahiti was intended for humans to take over. All the stuff here had come from Earth about 1 million years ago, and the evolution had followed so close a path that you recognized things at once. Pine, oak, walnut, chestnut, fir, holly, apple, ash, deer, bird, mouse, cat squirrel, monkey. The humanoids on Hain Davenant, of course, claimed they'd done it at the same time as they colonized Earth. But if you listened to those ETs, you'd find they claimed to have settled every planet in the galaxy and invented everything from sex to thumbtacks. The theories about Atlantis were a lot more realistic, and this might well be a lost Atlantean colony. But the humans had died out, and the nearest thing that had developed from the monkey line to replace them was the Creechy, a meter tall and covered with green fur. As ETs, they were about standard, but as men, they were a bust. They just hadn't made it. Give them another million years, maybe. But the conquistadors had arrived first. Evolution moved now not at a pace of a random mutation once a millennium, but with the speed of the starships of the Terran fleet. "Hey, Captain." Davidson turned, only a microsecond late in his reaction, but that was late enough to annoy him. There was something about this damn planet. Its gold sunlight and hazy sky, its mild winds smelling of leaf mold and pollen, something that made you daydream. You mooched along thinking about conquistadors and destiny and stuff till you were acting as thick and slow as a Creechy. "Morning, Ock," he said crisply to the logging foreman. Black and tough as wire rope, Aknanawi Nabo was Key's physical opposite. But he had the same worried look. "You got half a minute?"
"Sure. What's eating you, Ock?"
"The little bastards." They leaned their backsides on a split-rail fence. Davidson lit his first reefer of the day. Sunlight, smoke-blued, slanted warm across the air. The forest behind camp, a quarter-mile-wide uncut strip, was full of the faint, ceaseless, cracking, chuckling, stirring, whirring, silvery noises that woods in the morning are full of. It might have been Idaho in 1950, this clearing, or Kentucky in 1830, or Gaul in 50 B.C.
"Tweet,"
said a distant bird. "I'd like to get rid of them, Captain."
"The Creechies? How do you mean, Ock?"
"Just let them go. I can't get enough work out of them in the mill to make up for their keep, or for their being such a damn headache. They just don't work."
"They do if you know how to make them. They built the camp."
Aknanui's obsidian face was dour. "Well, you got the touch with them, I guess. I don't." He paused. "In that applied history course I took in training for Far Out, it said that slavery never worked. It was uneconomical."
"Right, but this isn't slavery, Ock baby. Slaves are humans. When you raise cows, you call that slavery? No, and it works."
Impassive, the foreman nodded, but he said, "They're too little. I tried starving the sulky ones. They just sit and starve."
"They're little, all right, but don't let them fool you, Ock. They're tough. They've got terrific endurance. And they don't feel pain like humans. That's the part you forget, Ock. You think hitting one is like hitting a kid, sort of. Believe me, it's more like hitting a robot, for all they feel it. Look, you've laid some of the females. You know how they don't seem to feel anything. No pleasure, no pain. They just lay there like mattresses, no matter what you do.
They're all like that.
Probably they've got more primitive nerves than humans do. Like fish. I'll tell you a weird one about that. When I was in Central, before I came up here, one of the tame males jumped me once. I know they'll tell you they never fight, but this one went splaw right off his nut. And lucky he wasn't armed or he'd have killed me. I had to damn near kill him before he'd even let go.
And he kept coming back. It was incredible, the beating he took. And never even felt it. Like some beetle you have to keep stepping on because it doesn't know it's been squashed already. Look at this." Davidson bent down his close-cropped head to show a gnarled lump behind one ear.
"That was damn near a concussion, and he did it after I'd broken his arm and pounded his face into cranberry sauce. He just kept coming back and coming back. The thing is, Ock, the Creechies are lazy. They're dumb. They're treacherous. And they don't feel pain. You've got to be tough with them, and stay tough with them. They aren't worth the trouble, Captain.
Damn sulky little green bastards. They won't fight. Won't work. Won't nothing. Except give me a pip. There was a geniality in Akhnanoe's grumbling, which did not conceal the stubbornness beneath. He wouldn't beat up creatures because they were so much smaller. That was clear in his mind, and clear now to Davidson, who at once accepted it. He knew how to handle his men. Look, Ak, try this. Pick out the ringleaders and tell them you're going to give them a shot of hallucinogen. Mesk, lice, anyone, they don't know one from the other. But they're scared of them. Don't overwork it, and it'll work. I can guarantee. Why are they scared of Hallies? The foreman asked curiously. How do I know? Why are women scared of rats? Don't look for good sense from women or creatures, Ak. Speaking of which, I'm on the way to Central this morning. Shall I put the finger on a collie girl for you? Just keep the finger off a few till I get my leave, Ak said, grinning. A group of creatures passed, carrying a long 12x12 beam for the rec room being built down by the river. Slow, shambling little figures, they worried the big beam along like a lot of ants with a dead caterpillar, sullen and inept. Akhnanoe watched them and said, "Fact is, Captain, they give me the creeps." That was queer, coming from a tough, quiet guy like Ak. "Well, I agree with you, actually, Ak, that they're not worth the trouble or the risk. If that fart Lyubov wasn't around, and the colonel wasn't so stuck on following the code, I think we might just clean out the areas we settle, instead of this voluntary labor routine. They're going to get rubbed out sooner or later, and it might as well be sooner. It's just how things happen to be. Primitive races always have to give way to civilized ones, or be assimilated. But we sure as hell can't assimilate a lot of green monkeys. And like you say, they're just bright enough that they'll never be quite trustworthy. Like those big monkeys used to live in Africa. What were they called? Gorillas. Right. We'll get on better without creatures here, just like we got on better without gorillas in Africa. They're in our way. But Daddy Ding Dong, he say use creature labor, so we use creature labor. For a while, right? See you tonight, Ak. Right, Captain. Davidson checked out the hopper from Smith Camp HQ. A pine plank, 4-meter cube, 2 desks, a water cooler. Lieutenant Burno repairing a walkie-talkie.
Don't let the camp burn down, Burno.
Bring me back a collie, Cap. Blonde. 34-22-36.
Christ, is that all? I like 'em neat, not floppy, see?
Burno expressively outlined his preference in the air. Grinning, Davidson went on up to the hangar. As he brought the helicopter back over camp, he looked down at it. Kids' blocks, sketch lines of paths, long stump-stubbled clearings, all shrinking as the machine rose and he saw the green of the uncut forests of the great island. And beyond that dark green, the pale green of the sea, going on and on. Now Smith Camp looked like a yellow spot, a fleck on a vast green tapestry. He crossed Smith Straits and the wooded, deep-folded ranges of North Central Island and came down by noon in Centralville. It looked like a city, at least after 3 months in the woods. There were real streets, real buildings. It had been there since the colony began 4 years ago. You didn't see what a flimsy little frontier town it really was until you looked south of it a half mile and saw, glittering above the stump lands and the concrete pads, a single golden tower, taller than anything in Centralville. The ship wasn't a big one, but it looked so big here. And it was only a launch, a lander, a ship's boat. The Nafal ship of the line, Shackleton, was 500,000 kilos up, in orbit. The launch was just a hint, just a fingertip of the hugeness, the power, the golden precision and grandeur of the star-bridging technology of Earth. That was why tears came to Davidson's eyes for a second at the sight of the ship from home. He wasn't ashamed of it. He was a patriotic man, and it just happened to be the way he was made. Soon enough, walking down those frontier town streets with their wide vistas of nothing much at each end, he began to smile. For the women were there, all right, and you could tell they were fresh ones. They mostly had long, tight skirts and big shoes like galoshes, red or purple or gold, and gold or silver frilly shirts, no more nipple peeps. Fashions had changed. Too bad. They all wore their hair piled up high. It must be sprayed with that glue stuff they used. Ugly as hell, but it was the sort of thing only women would do with their hair, and so it was provocative. Davidson grinned at a chesty little Yurif with more hair than head. He got no smile, but a wag of the retreating hips that said plainly, "Follow, follow, follow me." But he didn't. Not yet. He went to Central HQ. Quickstone and Plastiplate standard issue. 40 offices, 10 water coolers, and a basement arsenal. And checked in with New Tahiti Central Colonial Administration Command. He met a couple of the launch crew, put in a request for a new semi-robo bark stripper at forestry, and got his old pal Juju Sereng to meet him at the Luau Bar at 1400. He got to the bar an hour early to stock up on a little food before the drinking began. Lyubov was there, sitting with a couple of guys in fleet uniform, some kind of specials that had come down on the Shackleton's launch. Davidson didn't have a high regard for the Navy. A lot of fancy sunhoppers who left the dirty, muddy, dangerous on-planet work to the Army. But brass was brass, and anyhow, it was funny to see Lyubov acting chummy with anybody in uniform. He was talking, waving his hands around the way he did. Just in passing, Davidson tapped his shoulder and said, "Hi, Raj, old pal, how's tricks?" He went on without waiting for the scowl, though he hated to miss it. It was really funny the way Lyubov hated him. Probably the guy was effeminate, like a lot of intellectuals, and resented Davidson's virility. Anyhow, Davidson wasn't going to waste any time hating Lyubov. He wasn't worth the trouble. The Luau served a first-rate venison steak. What would they say on old Earth if they saw one man eating a kilogram of meat at one meal? Poor damn soybean suckers. Then Juju arrived with, as Davidson had confidently expected, the pick of the new collie girls. Two fruity beauties, not brides, but recreation staff. Oh, the old colonial administration sometimes came through. It was a long, hot afternoon. Flying back to camp, he crossed Smith Straits level with the sun that lay on top of a great gold bed of haze over the sea. He sang as he lolled in the pilot seat. Smith Land came into sight, hazy, and there was smoke over the camp. A dark smudge, as if oil had got into the waste burner. He couldn't even make out the buildings through it. It was only as he dropped down to the landing field that he saw the charred jet, the wrecked hoppers, the burned-out hangar. He pulled the hopper up again and flew back over the camp, so low that he might have hit the high cone of the burner, the only thing left sticking up. The rest was gone. Mill, furnace, lumber yards, HQ, huts, barracks, Creechy compound. Everything. Black hulks and wrecks, still smoking. But it hadn't been a forest fire. The forest stood there, green, next to the ruins. Davidson swung back round to the field, set down, and lit out, looking for the motorbike. But it, too, was a black wreck, along with the stinking, smoldering ruins of the hangar and the machinery. He loped down the path to camp. As he passed what had been the radio hut, his mind snapped back into gear. Without hesitating for even a stride, he changed course, off the path, behind the gutted shack. There he stopped. He listened. There was nobody. It was all silent. The fires had been out a long time. Only the great lumber piles still smoldered, showing a hot red under the ash and char. Worth more than gold, those oblong ash heaps had been. But no smoke rose from the black skeletons of the barracks and huts, and there were bones among the ashes. Davidson's brain was super clear and active now as he crouched behind the radio shack. There were two possibilities. One, an attack from another camp. Some officer on King or New Java had gone spla and was trying a coup de planète. Two, an attack from off-planet. He saw the golden tower on the space dock at Central. But if the Shackleton had gone privateer, why would she start by rubbing out a small camp instead of taking over Centralville? No, it must be invasion. Aliens. Some unknown race. Or maybe the Setians. Or the Hainish had decided to move in on Earth's colonies. He'd never trusted those damn smart humanoids. This must have been done with a heat bomb. The invading force, with jets, air cars, nukes, could easily be hidden on an island or reef anywhere in the southwest quarter sphere. He must get back to his hopper and send out the alarm, then try a look around, reconnoiter, so he could tell HQ his assessment of the actual situation. He was just straightening up when he heard the voices. Not human voices. High, soft, gabble-gobble. Aliens. Ducking on hands and knees behind the shack's plastic roof, which lay on the ground, deformed by heat into a batwing shape, he held still and listened. Four creatures walked by, a few yards from him on the path. They were wild creatures, naked, except for loose leather belts on which knives and pouches hung. None wore the shorts and leather collar supplied to tame creatures. The volunteers in the compound must have been incinerated along with the humans. They stopped a little way past his hiding place, talking their slow gabble-gobble, and Davidson held his breath. He didn't want them to spot him. What the devil were creatures doing here? They could only be serving as spies and scouts for the invaders. One pointed south as it talked, and turned so that Davidson saw its face, and he recognized it. Creatures all looked alike, but this one was different. He had written his own signature all over that face, less than a year ago. It was the one that had gone spla and attacked him down in Central, the homicidal one, Lyubov's pet. What in the blue hell was it doing here? Davidson's mind raced, clicked. Reactions fast as always, he stood up, sudden, tall, easy, gun in hand. You creatures, stop. Stay put, no moving. His voice cracked out like a whiplash. The four little green creatures did not move. The one with the smashed-in face looked at him across the black rubble with huge, blank eyes that had no light in them. Answer now. This fire. Who started? No answer. Answer now. Hurry up quick. No answer. Then I burn up first one, then one, then one, see? This fire. Who started? We burned the camp, Captain Davidson, said the one from Central, in a queer, soft voice that reminded Davidson of some human. The humans are all dead. You burned it, what do you mean? He could not recall Scarface's name for some reason. There were 200 humans here. 90 slaves of my people. 900 of my people came out of the forest. First, we killed the humans in the place in the forest where they were cutting trees. Then we killed those in this place, while the houses were burning. I had thought you were killed. I am glad to see you, Captain Davidson.
It was all crazy. And of course, a lie. They couldn't have killed all of them. Ock, Berno, Van Sten, all the rest. 200 men. Some of them would have got out. All the Creechies had was bows and arrows. Anyway, the Creechies couldn't have done this. Creechies didn't fight, didn't kill, didn't have wars. They were intraspecies non-aggressive. That meant sitting ducks. They didn't fight back. They sure as hell didn't massacre 200 men at a swipe. It was crazy. The silence, the faint stink of burning in the long, warm evening light, the pale green faces with unmoving eyes that watched him. It all added up to nothing. To a crazy bad dream. A nightmare.
Who did this for you?
900 of my people, Scarface said in that damned, fake human voice.
No, not that. Who else? Who are you acting for? Who told you what to do?
My wife did.
Davidson saw then the telltale tension of the creature's stance, yet it sprang at him so lithe and oblique that his shot missed, burning an arm or shoulder instead of smack between the eyes. And the creature was on him, half his size and weight, yet knocking him right off balance by its onslaught, for he had been relying on the gun and not expecting attack. The thing's arms were thin, tough, coarse furred in his grip, and as he struggled with it, it sang. He was down on his back, pinned down, disarmed. Four green muzzles looked down at him. The scar-faced one was still singing, a breathless gabble, but with a tune to it. The other three listened, their white teeth showing in grins. He had never seen a creechy smile. He had never looked up into a creechy's face from below, always down from above, from on top. He tried not to struggle, for at the moment it was wasted effort. Little as they were, they outnumbered him, and Scarface had his gun. He must wait. But there was a sickness in him, a nausea that made his body twitch and strain against his will. The small hands held him down effortlessly. The small green faces bobbed over him, grinning. Scarface ended his song. He knelt on Davidson's chest, a knife in one hand, Davidson's gun in the other.
You can't sing, Captain Davidson, is that right? Well then, you may run to your hopper and fly away, and tell the colonel in Central that this place is burned and the humans are all killed.
Blood, the same startling red as human blood, clotted the fur of the creature's right arm, and the knife shook in the green paw. The sharp, scarred face looked down into Davidson's from very close, and he could see now the queer light that burned way down in the charcoal dark eyes. The voice was still soft and quiet.
They let him go.
He got up cautiously, still dizzy from the fall Scarface had given him. The Creechies stood well away from him now, knowing his reach was twice theirs. But Scarface wasn't the only one armed. There was a second gun pointing at his guts. That was Ben holding the gun, his own Creechie Ben. The little gray mangy bastard looking stupid as always, but holding a gun.
It's hard to turn your back on two pointing guns, but Davidson did it and started walking towards the field.
A voice behind him said some creechy word, shrill and loud. Another said, "Hurry up quick!" And there was a queer noise like birds twittering that must be creechy laughter. A shot clapped and whined on the road right by him.
Christ! It wasn't fair. They had the guns and he wasn't armed.
He began to run. He could outrun any creechy. They didn't know how to shoot a gun.
Run, said the quiet voice far behind him. That was Scarface. Selver, that was his name.
Sam, they'd called him, till Yubov stopped Davidson from giving him what he deserved and made a pet out of him.
Then they'd called him Selver. Christ, what was all this? It was a nightmare. He ran. The blood thundered in his ears. He ran through the golden, smoky evening. There was a body by the path. He hadn't even noticed it coming. It wasn't burned. It looked like a white balloon with the air gone out. It had staring blue eyes. They didn't dare kill him, Davidson. They hadn't shot at him again. It was impossible. They couldn't kill him. There was the hopper, safe and shining, and he lunged into the seat and had her up before the creatures could try anything. His hands shook, but not much. Just shock. They couldn't kill him. He circled the hill and then came back fast and low, looking for the four creatures. But nothing moved in the streaky rubble of the camp. There had been a camp there this morning, 200 men. There had been four creatures there just now. He hadn't dreamed all this. They couldn't just disappear. They were there, hiding. He opened up the machine gun in the hopper's nose and raked the burned ground, shot holes in the green leaves of the forest, strafed the burned bones and cold bodies of his men and the wrecked machinery and the rotting white stumps, returning again and again until the ammo was gone and the gun's spasms stopped short. Davidson's hands were steady now. His body felt appeased, and he knew he wasn't caught in any dream. He headed back over the straits to take the news to Centralville. As he flew, he could feel his face relax into its usual calm lines. They couldn't blame the disaster on him, for he hadn't even been there. Maybe they'd see that it was significant that the Creeches had struck while he was gone, knowing they'd fail if he was there to organize the defense. And there was one good thing would come out of this. They'd do like they should have done to start with, and clean up the planet for human occupation. Not even Lyubov could stop them from rubbing out the Creeches now, not when they heard it was Lyubov's pet Creechy who'd led the massacre. They'd go in for rat extermination for a while, now. And maybe, just maybe, they'd hand that little job over to him. At that thought, he could have smiled. But he kept his face calm. The sea under him was grayish with twilight, and ahead of him lay the island hills, the deep-folded, many-streamed, many-leaved forests in the dusk.